This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR. Produced by Timber Media.
Not to start today with a cliche, but these days have got me thinking that change really is the only constant, the only thing that we can take for granted in life. Think about it. We've got economic shifts, rapid advances in AI, evolving workforce expectations, and changing regulations that mean organizations can no longer afford to prepare only for the next disruption. Welcome to Great FM, everyone. Ahalya here. And yeah, getting back to the point, organizations need to spend every moment of every day building walls so strong that they're able to withstand any disruption that comes their way. This seems like a mammoth task, but it is one that has to be undertaken. In the Middle East, this challenge is even more nuanced. You know, organizations are balancing ambitious national transformation agendas, diverse multicultural workforces, increasing localization efforts, and the need to remain globally competitive all at the same time. No pressure. I mean, so perhaps the question for HR is no longer how do we develop talent, but how do we build a workforce that can adapt, recover, and continue performing through constant change? It's a big question, but one that we're going to explore on today's episode. So what workforce resilience really means in today's Middle East, not by chance, but by intent. To walk us through how one can make this mammoth task a reality, let's welcome Chris Shashitharan, head of HR Meta India and APAC at Emeritus. He's an executive MBA qualified multi-geo, multi-industry HR leader with over 20 years of experience, and honestly, the perfect voice to have on the show. Welcome, Chris. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Ahalya. It's a pleasure to join Great FM and do this podcast. And thank you for your kind and very flattering introduction. Appreciate that.
The flattery is going to continue because, you know, a quick look at your profile, and you've also lived, worked and covered markets in the UK, Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, Middle East, Africa. You know, with that kind of multicultural, diverse experience, I think you probably have an insider's perspective of what it takes to be resilient in more ways than one. And I think it has become a very popular concept in the world over the past few years, right? Resilience. The circumstances, I mean, have tested us all beyond our imagination. So that makes sense. And I think people are familiar with it on a very human level. But what does it mean for an organization to be resilient, Chris, if we could start there?
Yeah, sure. Look, I guess there's probably a dictionary definition of resilience, but from an organizational standpoint, we've always spoken about, you know, endurance, surviving, and words like that. From my perspective, I think resilience is very different. It's about being able to deal with, you know, all sorts of setbacks, anything that's unplanned, anything that's one hasn't foreseen. Mm-hmm. And being able to continue to kind of evolve. So in a nutshell, resilience is, you know, it's not about helping people survive disruption. It's about designing an organization that can absorb shocks, adapt quickly, and continue creating value. It's not about bouncing back. It's about bouncing forward in a nutshell. Let's just, you know, think about COVID, for example, right? COVID taught us something fascinating. For example, two companies could have similar talent, similar products, similar financial resources, and one struggled for years, whilst many others or the other one reinvented itself almost overnight. So, you know, in this instance, the difference wasn't resilience in individuals; it was resilience by design. So for me, organizational resilience, it's the ability to anticipate change, absorb disruption, adapt rapidly, and emerge stronger, not just simply recover. We often confuse, as I said earlier, resilience with endurance. Endurance means surviving. Resilience means evolving.
I think I'll take that over the dictionary definition any day. But I think it's also important then to take into consideration what we're measuring when we talk about resilience, right? Because if it is to take your point forward about evolution and evolving, when HR leaders talk about building a resilient workforce, what should they be measuring? And has it changed from maybe, say, 5 years ago, right? Is it retention, speed of adaptation, business continuity, or something else entirely?
I think companies still continue to, and we have been for years and probably decades, We've been measuring things like retention, attrition, engagement. They're important, but they are lagging indicators. You know, right? They're useful, but they tell you what's already happened. The future belongs to leading indicators, right? And I'd focus on five: the speed of skill acquisition. Please note, I'm using the word skill acquisition and not talent acquisition, and we'll come to that perhaps in one of the other questions. So the speed of skill acquisition is one. Internal mobility is another. Time taken to redeploy talent, and this ties back into skill acquisition, right? And we'll go through that. Manager effectiveness is the fourth one, and employee energy, not just engagement. The question isn't, can we retain people? The real question is, can our people reinvent themselves faster than the market changes? Right? That's what will be the key differentiator between one organization and another.
Yeah, well, you know, Chris, that in itself, that question is a very hard one for organizations to answer, let alone people themselves, right? And I do want to, we started the conversation in the context of the Middle East, so to pivot the discussion to a more geographical context. The Middle East has experienced this extraordinary economic and technological transformation over the last decade. So what makes workforce resilience a strategic priority in this region right now compared to 5 or 10 years ago? Surely resilience is something people have always been focused on, but is it even more important today in the context of the Middle East?
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, in the introduction, you referenced, you know, the places I've lived and worked in, right? So it's been across, you know, Eastern Europe, obviously Europe and Asia, Middle East, and Africa, and so on. Particularly with the Middle East, to your point, in the current climate, you know, let's look at four trends, if we will. One is vision-led transformation, right? So countries aren't making incremental improvements. They're actually redesigning economies. If you know, if you look at the usual buzzwords, right? Saudi Vision 2030, and even in the UAE, for example, you know, there are companies which have a vision XYZ, whether that's 2030, 2035, et cetera, right? I know one of the UAE banks, for example, has a vision 2035 or something like that. The country itself, so UAE itself, you know, their AI strategy, right? They're pumping loads into being at the forefront of AI, and massive investments across technology, tourism, logistics, and sustainability, right? So everything's moving simultaneously. So that's the first trend. The first trend is vision-led transformation. The second trend is, and this has been around for a while, but it's more important now. The second trend is global, you know, competition for talent. The Middle East isn't importing labor or talent anymore. It's competing for global expertise. The third one is AI adoption. The region is actively positioning itself as an AI hub rather than waiting for disruption. And then the last one is demographic diversity. The Middle East, and particularly the UAE, has always been a kind of melting pot of people from different cultures, different parts of the world, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Some organizations in the UAE have over 100 nationalities. That in itself creates the opportunity for tremendous innovation. You know, when you think of people from different cultures, from different countries, with different backgrounds and education, there is an opportunity with different ideas to come through. However, and there is a however, whilst it creates an opportunity for tremendous innovation, it's only possible if leaders know how to harness it. So workforce resilience has shifted from an HR priority to a national competitiveness issue. And countries like the UAE, Saudi, etc., are recognizing that and are leading through their vision-led transformation. So just to recap, four trends: vision-led transformation, global competition for talent, AI adoption, and demographic diversity.
Nice. And you brought up this idea of skills-based hiring, right? I think it's a good time to dive into that further and see how it really ties into this conversation of building a resilient workforce and what it has to do with building a resilient workforce beyond, you know, just its DEI implications.
Yeah. Interesting question. There's been chatter, debates, and a lot in more recent times about companies moving towards or to a skills-based hiring approach. Many organizations still hire on experience. You look at a CV and or you write a job description and say must have worked in XYZ sector or must have done this, et cetera, et cetera. That's becoming or starting to become a little bit old-fashioned, given how everything's evolving so quickly these days. So the answer to organizations' challenges isn't about, you have a vacancy, you hire and go, oh, let's bring someone with this background, et cetera, et cetera. And you hire them and you could plug that gap. But talent itself is hard to find these days. And so organizations are sometimes missing a trick when they just go and find someone else externally with with a certain background. That's where skills-based hiring comes in, right? It's not just a recruitment strategy, it's a resilience strategy. And the reason is, look, skills age slower than job titles. Job titles become obsolete. We know that, right? We know that even now with AI coming on board, there are so many roles that will become obsolete. But what remains is a capability, right? Capabilities evolve. So if you recruit people for learning agility instead of experience alone, you will build an organization that can pivot much faster. And one thing that many organizations, I don't want to name them, but many organizations, some large organizations, and even one of my ex-employers, one of the things that they're doing is that they work through something called internal talent marketplaces, right? So rather than buying every new skill externally, they move talent internally, right? So somebody may not have a background in XYZ, but they'll have a skill that they can offer you. And when that exists in your organization, why would you go and try and plug that gap by hiring externally, right? Moving internal talent is faster, it's cheaper, and the best part is it improves engagement and retention. So,
Absolutely.
that's the beauty of skills-based hiring. Now, of course, you can also hire, outside hires or external hires through the same approach, but it's important to distinguish between experience and skills-based hiring.
Yeah, that's a very interesting connection that you've drawn. I think it would be unwise to leave AI out of the conversation because this phenom, even internal talent marketplaces, even skills acquisition has, I think, accelerated with the AI disruption, right? I mean, it's changing jobs faster than organizations can even rewrite their job descriptions. So I think I'd also like to pivot the conversation to how AI, can possibly help build resilience. It is the disruptor. It's always viewed as the disruptor, but can it actually help build resilience?
Look, let's start by avoiding this fear that everyone seems to have that AI is replacing people. AI isn't, at least in my view, AI isn't replacing people. It's replacing tasks, roles, things that people do on a day-to-day basis. And it's doing it in a better fashion, right? So it would be unwise to ignore AI because it helps the organization become more efficient. Let's look at it from a slightly different lens, right? Let's say that AI changes work. It changes what you and I do every day, and it hopefully enriches what you and I do because it takes care of some of the things that are probably quite mundane, repetitive, and so on. It makes your job and my job more interesting. So AI changes work. So what does a resilient organization do? It asks a different question. A resilient organization doesn't say which jobs disappear. Instead, they say which work becomes more valuable. And so if you look at it from that lens, then AI helps resilience because it predicts workforce risks. It has the ability to identify future skill gaps. It personalizes learning, right? One of the best things about AI is we can customize things at scale, right? So it personalizes learning. We all know what it does. It automates repetitive work, right? That's clear, very clear to most people. And by doing all of this, it improves workforce planning. So that's where organizations need to be careful and not left behind by ignoring AI.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason I called it a mammoth task at the start of this conversation because there's so much that goes into building a resilient organization. I think you've raised some really valid shifts in, the questions that we're asking of ourselves and of our organizations. I want to add on to the point about resilient systems can't possibly have one without the employees that comprise your workforce, right? So if we could also bring them into the conversation now, I think the scope around employee well-being has matured significantly over the past few years, especially post-COVID. How do you think psychological safety, manageable workloads, and also employee well-being kind of directly influence an organization's ability to stay resilient during periods of uncertainty? To me, this feels like one of the most important pillars.
Yeah, you're right. Look, I mean, take that word well-being, right? I find it quite interesting and fascinating that in some ways HR has kind of come a full circle. We're talking about maybe a century or so ago when, there were something called the Quaker companies, right? So people like Cadbury's and some of the other well-established businesses, they've made their mark by being caring employers, right? And I think over time in the 70s and 80s, 1970s and 80s, things moved into human capital and companies going down treating people like resources. And we've now come a full circle. If you look at the shift just to HR job titles, right? People are moving towards people and culture, CPOs, chief people officer, and so on and so forth. So, well-being is no longer a benefit with an inverted commas, right? It's not an employee perk. It's an infrastructure, especially as you mentioned, since COVID. Many organizations are fully or partially remote, so people are working different hours. In those types of organizations, they have pivoted. I mean, Emeritus is one of them where we're more output driven rather than input driven. So it's not about spending 15 hours a day in front of your laptop. It's more about what you do in the 8, 9, 10 hours that you work, how effective and efficient you are. So it's not an employee perk, it's an infrastructure, and how do you build an infrastructure where well-being becomes part and parcel of that? Because look, simply put, exhausted people don't innovate, burnt out teams don't adapt, and most importantly, people only raise risks, challenge assumptions, and innovate when they feel safe doing so, right? And that's where psychological safety, as you mentioned, is really, really important. That's resilience, right? And if you can crack this and ensure that your people are recognized, they're allowed to do their best work, and you create an environment of where people can raise queries, and challenge and push the envelope, that's when you create a resilient organization.
Yeah, 100% agree with you there. I mean, employee well-being cannot. It blows my mind that it ever was positioned as a perk in the first place. And I'm very
Exactly.
glad, yeah, that we've overcome that hump. You know, at least there's been some progress there. But a very, again, valid point about the fact that, you know, tired people, burnt out teams also brings this sense of apathy into the workforce, which is very hard to get rid of, you know, like a wine stain on a rug or something like that once it sets in. So let's also talk about the whole top-down approach and what that has to do with building resilience in an organization. What leadership capabilities do you think are becoming essential when it comes to resilience within organizations? Surely a lot of it also depends on aligning people with very different expectations and working styles, right? Especially in the context of the Middle East, you're talking about a very diverse workforce, not just in terms of backgrounds, culture, geos, but also in terms of age. So, you know, how do you become the leader of a resilient organization?
Yeah, true. I mean, how do you become a leader in a resilient organization? Look, I'd say resilience today requires leaders who can manage paradox. Leaders who have the ability to inspire their teams and move fast while providing stability. So that's two different sides of the coin, right? Move fast, but provide stability. How do you do that? Drive performance while protecting well-being, right? So typically, driving performance means you got to push your people harder. You got to push them to bring their best to work. They've got to really, stretch themselves so that the organization keeps moving forward. But that's on the one hand, driving performance, while protecting well-being. That's the other side of the coin. Third one, right? Standardize where necessary. So that's kind of providing structure while encouraging innovation. And lastly, lead globally while remaining locally relevant. So you can see all of these things, right? And I'll repeat them. Move fast, stability. Drive performance, well-being. Standardize innovation and leading globally and locally relevant. They are two completely opposite sides of the spectrum. But leaders these days in organizations need to be able to do this constantly. If you've got to do this, then the capabilities that leaders or organizations need to build into their leaders is learning agility, which we've seen already, systems thinking. And the third one I love because it's never been more important than now is emotional intelligence, curiosity, and communication, right? So these are the five capabilities that will hopefully help you get to that stage. Nowadays, what's expected from the leader is not to have all the answers, but to build a team that can collectively figure out the right answers and ask better questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And no one ever said it was going to be easy, right? But that is why the
Yeah,
leader
exactly.
gets, yeah,
Absolutely.
that's why the leader gets called into action. As we reach the tail end of our conversation, Chris, and it's been such a wonderful one. Looking ahead, are there any workforce indicators? We started off by talking about how one should go about measuring resilience, right? So are there any indicators that HR leaders should monitor more closely in today's context within the Middle East to understand whether their organization's actually becoming more resilient, or is it becoming more vulnerable?
So we said, right, the lagging indicators, and that's been fashionable for so long. What we should try and do is introduce some fresh thinking into what we're measuring and why. So the better things or the more important things to measure will be things like internal mobility rate, right? So how are you redeploying people internally, which means that people are using their skills to the benefit of themselves, obviously, but also to the organization. So internal mobility rate is one. Second one, skills half-life, right? So again, beyond a certain point, skills also have a timeline to it. So how does an individual, or how, what sort of environment does the organization create so that the individual is constantly upskilling themselves? Because if the organization doesn't create the environment for them to do that, it's not just the individual that suffers. If the organization creates the environment, the organization benefits as well, right? So skills half-life, keep track of that. AI adoption rate, that's very obvious. I don't think it needs any definition. And so does the next one, learning velocity, right? We speak about agility, velocity. So agility obviously is how quickly you can learn, but velocity is also the speed at which you learn new things. The quality of your leadership bench, right? Have you built enough leaders so that it's the organization's moving in a sustainable, evolving fashion? Collaboration across functions. Many organizations recognize this, but they actually don't do a great job of promoting that to the benefit of the company. Employee energy levels. This is actually quite easy to track sometimes. When you have town halls and things like that, you see how many people attend, right? And that gives you an indication of how vested people are. And aligned to collaboration, kind of network health, right? So how connected are teams within your organization? Because when teams work together, when there's collaboration, there's more brains involved, which means that more questions are being asked, and more answers are being found. So look, organizations become vulnerable long before financial results show it, right? Because it takes some time before suddenly you say, oh, why are we not doing well? Well, why is EBITDA down, or why is revenue down? So if you keep track of these indicators, you'll be doing a good job of the financials as well. Efficiency wins stable markets. Adaptability wins uncertain ones, right? I'll kind of leave you with that thought.
It's a lovely thought to ponder over. And I think we'll end the conversation with one last question, which is your direct advice to a CHRO who might be listening to this podcast today, and starting this journey of resilience, right? Sure, people have always worked on it, but it is time, like we opened the conversation with, to do it with absolute intention to set ourselves up for success. So, what are the two or three foundational changes that you think they'd need to make over the next 12 months to build a workforce that is ready for whatever comes their way?
Look, I think three priorities. Let's keep it simple, right? It's not a long list, and not in any particular order, but I'll still number them. So priority number one, build skills, not structures. So what does that mean? It means you invest in continuous learning because the strongest organizations aren't the biggest. They're the fastest learners, right? So that's first one. Next one, redesign leadership. Develop, adaptable leaders rather than technical experts alone. In the past, again, as I said, people were hired because they were fantastic at, something that was quite technical. With AI coming on board now, technical expertise or the value of technical expertise is diminishing to some extent. So develop adaptable leaders rather than technical experts alone. I'm not saying technical expertise is not important, but adaptability is equally important or probably more important. And the last one, use AI to augment people, not replace them. We've spoken about this already, right? Technology should increase human capability, not diminish it. Right, so we often ask whether our organizations are ready for the future, but the better question is whether our people can continuously create the future. I'll leave you with that.
Again, a very valuable thought to ponder over, as much of this conversation has brought to the table, Chris. Thank you so much for being with us,
Thank
and
you.
lending your voice to Great FM. Yeah, a super valuable conversation, and I hope everyone listening has taken something from it. Lots to think about. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on the podcast. Appreciate it.
This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR. Produced by Timber Media.